session is Clues to the Kingdom 1. Now, I was asked to do something, and I said I would do something if it would be an easy something, that I wouldn't have to read something heavy and prepared, and could do what I have seen authors and people like that doing at colleges for years and years and years. And in a way, I resented it, because in comes Grace Paley, famous Eastern, or famous all over the world, author, and she maybe gets $3,000-$4,000 for her evening. And what does she do? She reads from her own writings. And here I spend days, hours, weeks, months preparing talks. And so I grabbed at the chance to read something that I've written long, long, long ago. So I'm going to read from Clues to the Kingdom, which I began here at Holden Village. So it's rather precious to me. And when someone asks me, when were you at Holden Village last, I have to run to the book and see that the book was published in 68. That means that I wrote it in 67. And apparently the fullness of time came in 67 when I was here at Holden Village and I began to deliver. You see, writing a book is like a pregnancy. And apparently I was very pregnant when I came to Holden Village, and it started to get born. And I wrote the first poem at Ten Mile Falls, Creek Falls, is that it? Ten Mile Creek Falls. And the poem never got in the book, because after I'd finished the book, it didn't fit anywhere. So it is not in the book, and I can't read it to you. And I wrote all the way across Canada on the Canadian Railroad from Vancouver to Thunder Bay, where Howard picked me up. And you know, that's a 2.5-day trip, I guess. And I wrote madly. It came very quickly, relatively speaking. You think it was a pretty long delivery. But relatively speaking, it was an easy delivery. And it, when I was through, I thought, where shall I send this? And I thought, it's sort of modern. And Augsburg, I didn't think, was very modern. So, and this is really strange how you think. And the Christmas cards that Missouri Lutheran Publishing House at Concordia, St. Louis, printed, they were modern. They were beautiful. I loved them. Augsburg was still printing those old-fashioned Christmas cards. So I sent it to Concordia Press, and I didn't know Roland Seabolt was there at that time. And he finally wrote back to me, and he said, I'm sorry, I couldn't get it through my board. But he said, I like it very, very much, and you must try to get it published. So then I sent it to Augsburg, and they wrote back, and it falls into poetic form. It's not poetry. I want to be known as someone who writes poetic prose, not as someone who writes prosy poetry. So, but it fell into poetic form. I sent it to them as poetic form. They wrote back and said that they would publish it if I would write it out straight, in straight lines, because it took too much space, too much white space was there. Gee, I was so mad. But I typed it out straight, you know, just like a doctoral thesis or something like that. And they accepted it. Then after about 2 months, Ollie Jacobson, Jensen, called me up and said, she had babysat our children, and she called me up and said, I'm illustrating your book. I said, I didn't know it was being illustrated. And she said, yeah, I'd like to come down and talk with you about it. So she came down, and I showed her the original manuscript. She said, and no, she showed me what she was doing. And I said, oh, I said, you're putting it back in the form in which it was. She said, you mean it wasn't straight prose? I said, no. She said, show me the original. And she said, it just falls into poetry. And she said, I'm going to put it back in its original form, or I'm going to give me this manuscript. And so she made it exactly the way I had written it. And then she handed it, when she was through, she handed it to the publisher, and they almost didn't publish it, but they did. And then later, Roland Sebald came to Augsburg Publishing House, and he did the second book that was published. So, what I'm going to do is start reading tonight. If I get so hoarse or get a coughing spell, Chris Norsted will continue reading. but I hope that I won't get that. Somebody asked me, where do you get your ideas? Every book is different that I've written. There isn't one alike. They have to come to me. They have to be born in me. And then I ponder for about, sometimes 2 years. If it's an elephant pregnancy, it could be 3 years. During that time, everything feeds the theme that I think the Spirit has given me. Everything feeds it. Then all of a sudden, the fullness of time has come, and I start to write. And as I said, the fullness of time came at Holden Village. But what the theme was, what did Christ mean when he said, unless you become like children, you cannot enter the kingdom? And we had eight children, and in the process of bringing them up, I had learned a great deal. Then I used our first grandchild. I was with her in Tacoma about a week ago. And she said, Grandma, did everything happen in that book the way you said it did? And I said, no, not really. I said, but I put into you all the experiences that I had with all your uncles and aunts when they were growing up. So you became sort of a symbol of child. Some of the things I said did actually happen. So then I thought I would make it like a crime, a mystery story, a crime. So here are the titles. Who says there's a crime? X marks the spot. The lost identity card. The numbers game. Men behind masks. The disfigured image. Fugitives without passports. Murdering the king's English. An ancient grudge. The jammed communication system. A moldy crust of bread. And so forth. You see, the chapter titles all sound as if it were a murder mystery, don't they? So, we'll start. I am not going to I'm going to skip toward the end. I'm watching the clock. And I'm going to read a chapter that fits perfectly what Fritz Norsted was telling us yesterday about freedom of the will. And I wanted to hear it because he may go up tomorrow. So I'm going to skip something, but I'll come back tomorrow and finish and go back and start where I left off. First chapter, who says there's a crime? Lord, what was hindermost in your thoughts when you said, I tell you this, unless you turn around. Incidentally, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Paul Bowe said I should ask that question. when you said, unless you turn around and become like children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Let's turn off the Galilean drivel about lilies and sparrows and fig trees and vineyards and sheep and shepherds, Jesus, and talk sense. Objective, scientific, 20th century sense. You know very well that when childhood is gone, it's gone and nothing on earth will touch it back. Black strap, molasses, yogurt, geritol, wheat germ, Finnish baths, Turkish baths, yogi exercises, calisthenics. If I read it now, I'd say jogging. And the whole alphabet of vitamins cannot fetch childhood back again. The only way we can turn around, as you yourself put it, Jesus, is to take a long, hard look at existence and crawl back into mother's womb, curl up in her warm, dark, hidden uterus, and never come out into the cruel world again. But then they stick you in the nut house, plug our brain waves into the electric socket and shock us back to the categorical facts, the graying, receding hairline, the failing, fading eyes, the puckering, corrugated neck, veins slackening, knotting, arteries corroding, hardening, stomach sagging, ulcerating, the tired bowels, the fagged sex organs, the arthritic knees, the ugly, corn-fretted feet, where death begins its slow upward creep. Furthermore, Jesus, you know very well that we resent having childhood taken from us. It seems to be a mark of our humanness to resent it. Does the seagull moan its molted feather? And the old moose buck the lack of the loss of passion? Does the tomcat wail for the madness of former moons? Or the horse for its skittish, coltish days? But we, who are supposed to crown your almighty Father's creation, are always trying to be what we were, always trying to invent ways to recapture our lost childhood. It seems to be a mark of our lostness. Lostness. Do you mean that we have lost more than childhood? As if childhood were not enough to lose? Is it the long decay that is adulthood were not enough to bear? You silent one, you let me rant on, and yet you say nothing. You know that I know what you mean, that you desire the life-wearying human body to stop contemplating the child's exuberant body. You ask the dying human spirit to contemplate the child's spirit again. You ask the human spirit to learn again the child's secret, the unique grace of childhood, the mystery of the kingdom. Lord, in the common parlance of the day, a mystery means a crime. A crime. Are you saying there was a crime? Or is? This is water, not coffee. Second chapter's X marks the spot. Lord, you also said, let the children come to me. Do not try to stop them, for the kingdom of God belongs to such as these. I tell you, whoever does not accept the kingdom of God like a child will never enter it. Who taught you your blunt speech, Lord? Chaste, unsophisticated Mother Mary? Spinning plain prose as honest as her homespun. Guileless, honest carpenter Joseph, paring and truing his words as he planed his wood. But Lord, good Lord, what have we done with your plain spoken words, your tough words, your teeth chattering words? Listen, you veterans of childhood. You are exiles, outsiders. Do you hear? Do you understand? You have lost a kingdom. And the mystery of how to get it back in, I have locked within the child. We have taken those words of yours which do not spell comfort, no matter how we jumble them, and have made them into a eulogy of childhood, a darling package deal, wrapped in little boy blue, dusted with talcum powder, and fastened with a pink safety pin. When a kingdom has been lost, and if not lost, in jeopardy. A kingdom so precious. Well, Lord, if I remember right what once I knew so well and have too long forgotten, you yourself put the price on it. You wrote it not in dollar signs, but in blood. Lord, compared to your earth-ranging, man-tracking spirit. I'm only an amateur detective. But if you don't mind, I would like to carry on a private investigation by your leave and with his professional help. There seem to be two mysteries here. One, the mystery of how we lose, wander from, go astray from, fail to keep, fail to win the kingdom. Two, the mystery of how to find again, and keep, if we have found, the kingdom. There's a bewildering array of suspicions and suspects. All I know for sure now is the ABC of the case. Incidentally, a pastor told me this summer, and I'd never thought of it. He said, you know, Edna, what you wrote in Clues to the Kingdom is a Kierkegaard primer. I just sat beside a dear new friend I found here, founder of LBI, first of all, in Seattle. And she's here. And she told me that she had been here at Holden Village once, and Kierkegaard was discussed, but she couldn't understand it. And I said, you will understand me when I give you Kierkegaard in the ABC primer. And A, the kingdom is infinitely precious, and we are infinitely precious to the kingdom. B, this is the ABC. You are not profoundly scandalized by our losing or jeopardizing the kingdom. You are profoundly grieved. C, you are not demanding perfection of us. You demand that we accept the kingdom like a child. Whatever that means. Lord, I have a feeling that a red balloon and a smudged window pane have more meaning in this mystery than a blood-stained razor and a sinister fingerprint. An abandoned toy truck in a sandbox will provide more clues than the abandoned getaway car. I have to wet my throat. The third chapter is called The Lost Identity Card. And the illustrator almost drew a perfect picture of my three-year-old oldest grandchild. And this came to me because of our own firstborn son when he started to school. I remember a time when we had guests at our house, and it was about 3 o'clock when he came home from school. And we were sitting and having coffee in the kitchen. He opened the door and came in, and he stood at the door and he said, "Here I am!" And we thought, what profound confidence that we were happy that he was there. So that made this chapter. You work fast, Lord. Yesterday the doorbell rang. I opened the door, and there stood your clue giver, child. Kristen, her name. 3 years young, my granddaughter. Her sly parents hid behind the lilac bush. "Here I am," she cried. "Here's Kristen." "Here I am, only I alone. There's no other I. There never was, there never will be. I happen but once, never before, never again. Look at me, who do you see? Me, Kristen. I'm only three, but I am who I am." And there she was indeed, a once-only being who had already found her once-only self. 3 years ago, creation spoke, "Let there be Kristen." And Kristen was and is a new-fledged reality, original, unique, complete, absolute. All sorts of begetting and begatting went to make Kristen. I had a hand in the production myself. And yet, in spite of biochemistry, despite ancestral pedigree, Kristen is not a soiled copy, a shop-worn ditto, a fourth or fifth slightly revised edition of the same. Lord, is this your first clue to the crime of losing a kingdom? Are you telling me that I have lost my ID card? the true identity, the unique self you gave to me? Could I stand in the door of the kingdom with all the aplomb of Kristen in my doorway and say, here I am. Here is the self you gave to me, to no other but me, to become. Ah, my Lord, I seek clues to the kingdom, and you give me the third degree. I hear your question. Why are you not fully and completely your own self? It isn't like the human brand of questions. Why are you not your peerless grandfather? Why are you not your illustrious ancestors? Why are you a disgrace to the family? May I ask a question, Lord? How does one get back the ID card one has carelessly thrown away? And the next chapter is called The Numbers Game. Kristen did not stand in my doorway and say, here we are. We, the family, the clan, the generation, the race, the gang, the team, the fraternity, the firm, the corporation, the public, the majority, the party, the state, the nation. The child said, I. Kristen did not say, here's a social security number. Here's a punched hole in an IBM card. See, I've forgotten what IBM is. Oh, okay. Must have gone out of business. Here's a statistical item in a census poll. Here's a baptized Christian digit in the church files. The child said, I. Kristen did not say, I am more than you see. There's ever so much more of me. Don't look at me. Look at my public image, the one my hired image maker made. Public relations, see. There you will see the me I want you to see. The child said, I. Kristen did not say, I'm a zero that adds to nothing, a flub, a flop, and a failure. The stupid, blundering miscreation of a 10th-rate junior fate discarded before I was ever born. The child said, I. Lord, have we lost the kingdom because we have forgotten the simple kingdom arithmetic which reveres one, which does not add, subtract, multiply, or divide one? Because we have forgotten your sublime arithmetic, which is like none of the world's arithmetic. In the world, 1,000 is more than one. One is less than 1,000. In the kingdom, one is more than 1,000. 1,000 is less than one. That's got that out of Kierkegaard. Well, it's happened again. The clue I pounced upon grows barbs and fastens in my proud flesh. The auditor who came to examine the kingdom accounts is audited and found hiding in the crowd. Adam hid from you in the bushes, and I, Lord, I hide from you in the crowd. They say one can't teach an old dog new tricks. Is it possible, Lord, to teach an old cipher in an anonymous entity she calls society, old truths, simple elemental truths she knew as a child? incidentally, I never hand in a slip on communion day. I refuse to have the times I go to communion be counted, because I don't believe in counting the times one goes to communion. So. On the books, I never go to communion, but I always go to communion. Men behind masks, this is the next chapter. All day long, I wondered what clue you were trying to communicate to me And finally, when I leaned over her crib tonight to say goodnight, it crashed through the barricade of my old stale opinions. All day, Kristen's Sunday face has been no different in its sunniness and cloudiness, in its gleefulness and poutiness, than her Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday face. Why, I asked myself, are adult Sunday faces, adult vacation faces, adult retirement faces, and sometimes preachers' Monday faces, sad faces? Strange, I never thought of it before, because they've lost their function. And if perchance we wear our function faces fiercely on Sunday and vacation days, it may well be that we are using Sundays and vacations to make ourselves function better when we function. Ah, Lord, I suspect we sometimes even use you to procure and ensure well-being and success in our functions. Child's brain has not yet oozed into his fingertips and muscles. Child's will has not yet congealed into her habits and duties. Child has not yet put on the stereotyped face of function. Child's meaning is not yet synonymous with her doing. Child is not yet what he does. Kristen's face is still her own, not the teacher or the preacher mask, the manager or the director mask, the wife, husband, and parent mask. Kristen's face is the true, transparent face your father gave to her. Lord, if we may come back into your kingdom, we may for a time feel like a nun who somehow has wandered into a nudist camp. All those naked faces, those faces stripped of their function masks, may shock us until our eyes become accustomed to the radiance of the peeled pith of self. Let's see. Yeah, okay. This next one is the disfigured image. And here I bring another one of her cousins in, and she said, did I really throw sand in Kevin's face? And did he really scratch me? And I said, no, he didn't. Kristen wrecked Kevin's four-lane superhighway accidentally. And Kevin threw sand in Kristen's eyes. Kristen scratched Kevin's face intentionally. Kevin went home crying, and his mother came over fuming. After Kristen went to bed tonight, I went to my shelf of poets, where I always go when I get a cinder in my eye and a sliver of ice in my heart. The poem leaped out at me from printed page. Aha, I thought, another clue, and where I least expected it. The Kingdom of God by Francis Thompson. You wrote The Friend of Heaven, The Hound of Heaven, you know. This is less well known. The angels keep their ancient places, turn but a stone and start a wing. Tis your estranged faces that miss the many splendored thing. Tis we and our estranged faces, tis I and my estranged face that miss the many splendored thing. Lord, I'm more than embarrassed. Why did you let me spout about pseudo-selves and function masks? As if all we have to do to re-enter the kingdom is to rip off the masks and present the transparent face of childhood? When you know what you have always known, that the face of man, though peeled of masks, is smeared, smirched, stained, defamed, in the utter brightness of your kingdom, not even child. Sometime, when a cinder turns into an image of horror, burning the eyeball, and a sliver of ice into a glacier, freezing the heart's blood. Poets do not suffice. And so I went to your word, the first book of Moses, commonly called Genesis. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Once upon an eon, when Creator God bent over to look into the face of man, Creator God saw his own reflected image. When God bent over once again and looked into man's face, he saw no reflected image. He saw the mark of Cain, Dachau, and Hiroshima, a livid scratch on Kevin's cheek. God searches an old woman's face to find his likeness there and sees, "Have mercy, Lord, have mercy." Now I'll read one more, and then I'll read the one I want Fritz to hear before he leaves. Billy. This is called Fugitives Without Passports. Today I called Kristen's parents and asked if she could stay another week. I did not tell them I was investigating a crime and that their daughter was providing clues, thick and fast. They sounded lonesome, reluctantly granted me a week's grandmother's indulgence. Well, maybe, as long as she's happy. Happy? Kristen is happiness incarnate. I have a feeling her happiness, child's happiness, is connected somehow with the kingdom. To that end, and for my dossier, I translated two of Kristen's happy songs, the songs without words her being hums, and she who has ears to hear, hears. Song one. This is not great poetry. I have a little circle that goes around with me. I'm always in the middle, secure as I can be. The roundness of an apple, the fullness of a pear, accompany their center like the circle which I wear. It cribs me like a blanket. My personal universe eternally surrounds me, its happy nucleus. Song two. Ring-a-ding-ding, ring-a-ding-ding, ring by stars and sun and sea. Everything, everything rings around me. Rings around me. Swing-ling-ling, swing-ling-ling, the lovely things in my galaxy swing round and round about me, round about me. Spring-ling-ling, spring-ling-ling, the lively things that dance with glee, sunbeams and such, dance around me, dance around me. Sing-ling-ling, sing-ling-ling, the red, red robin in the cherry tree is lyrical for me, is lyrical for me. I suppose one of the biggest shocks I ever had was to find out that what the bird that is singing in the spring is not singing that at all. He's singing, "Get the hell out of here. This is my territory." That was a shock. I still like to think the other. Ah, Lord, the trust and security of those who are loved is like a passport stitched into a secret pocket. And we, modern man, we who have lost faith and the kingdom, what are we but fugitives without passports, homeless in space, small ugly specks on a giant cogwheel, doomed to infernal circles, the great tri-impersonals, blind fate, blind force, blind fortune, washed us up on the beach of time. And therefore we are what we are, metaphysical bastards. We huddle together in our alien universe, wherever the whirlwind flung us, alone, afraid, superfluous, marginal. We clutch the rim of the hoop with breaking, tearing fingernails, wheeling, whirling, turning, spinning, ringing around the emptiness, the stupid, impersonal emptiness. Lord God, how does a fugitive without a passport, how does a person without a kingdom come to wear once more the child look, the proud look, the buoyant look of the divine right of citizenship in the kingdom. I'll take the other one slower. This is pure Kierkegaard. And then you take it slowly. It's called The Terrible Risk. And I think it was inspired by that film, do you remember The Red Balloon? Years and years ago. I think this chapter was inspired by that. And it's, the illustrator did a marvelous job. She has a balloon. This is the green balloon. The title of this chapter is The Terrible Risk. The green balloon, clenched and clutched, broke with a loud pop. Kristen wailed her loss. The red balloon, floating from open palm, curtsied, hitched a ride with a willing west wind, and soared away. Look at it go, yelled Kristen. Just look at it go. And the illustrator has her hand here and the red balloon soaring up into the sky. Very well, divine levity. I call the Holy Spirit all sorts of names. His holy oddity, divine levity. Very well, divine levity. You favorable wind who lift man to the kingdom. What symbol of freedom rides a red balloon? What will you say to one who is born to freedom and has lost her family rights, her kingdom privilege? What will you say to us who have set cautious limits to our lives, measured safe and easy goals, barricaded ourselves behind normalcy, shut out the unpredictable, and resigned ourselves to things as they are? What will you say to us who have sold our freedom to the great God, public opinion? What does the morning paper think? What does the TV commentator think? What do the pollsters think? What does the computer think? I was surprised to see that. I didn't know they'd invented computers at that time. If the computer says it's so, it must be so. What will you say to us who are slaves to our virtues as well as to our vices, thralls of our barren correctness and rigid perfection? We who comfort ourselves with our pet prejudices, mouth them as an infant sucks his pacifier, and achieve the same glazed contentment. We, the shoulder shruggers, the so waters, mouthing our stale cliches. I'm only human. I don't have what it takes. Whatever will be, will be. That's the way the cookie crumbles. We, the unconditionally conditioned ones, don't blame me, blame my mother. That possessive, domineering female who dowered me with her dour genes. That rigid, hypocritical mother church who filled me with morbid guilt feelings. My silly, senile Sunday school teachers who converted me into a Christian snob. My dear doltish alma mater who reconverted me into an intellectual snob. O spirit of freedom, what will you say to us who hide the horrifying state of our unfreedom in forlorn anxieties and frantic hustle and call this progress? And then the illustrator again did that marvelous job. Here's just the tail, just the tail, just leave it, please. The tail of a red balloon. And the hand down below says, and then Kristen says, look at
go. Just look at him go.
No, that isn't Kristen. That's God. And now this is absolutely pure Kierkegaard. Translated to something more simple, but it's pure Kierkegaard. Aha! I get it. You, almighty, all-competent, all-powered God. You who created a whole universe, every infinitesimal part of which is dependent upon your will. Yet you, powerful, tough, omnipotent. It was omnipotent, not omniscient. Omnipotent. Powerful, tough, omnipotent. You made the most fragile of all beings, a free being. The most fragile of all things, a free being. You cut the umbilical cord of dependence and gave man the terrible freedom to walk alone. You did not even put him in a walking harness. In Europe, at that time anyway, they put little toddlers in a walking harness with reins. See? You did not even put him in a walking harness. You removed your hand gently. And when you saw him walking alone, you had the omnipotence, you had the grace to say, look at him go. Just look at him go. Oh, incomprehensible mystery that you, the omnipotent, made me to be free. Oh, inconceivable marvel that you, the all-powerful, grant so much liberty to me that you ask me, will you have me or not? And wait for my answer. Continue to moonlight. If you have any questions, sir, 5 minutes you could ask some questions, or I could read you another chapter. You want it? What do you want?
How's your throat?
Pardon?
How's your throat?
My throat? My throat's okay. I don't know how it sounds to you. I hear myself through a hearing aid all the time, see, when I'm wearing a hearing aid, so I don't know how I sound. Do you have any questions?
How many books have you written?
Pardon?
How many books have you written?
Well, published. If you count the St. John's History, which is a book, and which was published, I suppose, I think there are 12, but they're not all in print. I think only about 4 or 5 are in print now. So there are 2 missing in the library here, and I'll see to it that you get them when I get home to send them to you sometime.
Where is home?
Home is Northfield, Minnesota. St. Olaf College, Northfield, Minnesota. How many of you are from Minnesota? How many of you from the Midwest? Okay. I thought a whole bunch of people came in from Minnesota today. I guess it
wasn't. Is that book out of print too?
Well, this has been out of print so long that, yeah, and we have only 2 copies because it neglected to tell us that it was going out of print. There were only 2 copies left, only one, so we got 1 extra copy. And now they tell us, so we're able to buy the remainders before they, you know what they do? They shred them. They shred the remaindered books. Because they don't want to pay the taxes. They have to pay taxes. It's books in stock. And that's why the average length of a published book nowadays is about 9 months. And then they remainder them because they don't want to pay taxes on books in stock. And what that's going to do to classic books, who's going to who's going to publish, republish classics? Because they're not going to sell as well as first books. And so I think the publishing of classic books is doomed, really. Our daughter is making a study of that. She's a librarian, and so she is making a study of, she's written to many, many publishers, what do you do with your remainder books? And she's getting answers. She's going to put it all together sometime.
Kind of almost like burning them.
Yeah, it is.
Well, some of the libraries have big sales where they sell them very, very reasonably. You know, is that the same thing? Is when you're getting rid of them?
No. Well, they've gotten books from remainder companies, you know.
I see.
You can get catalogs from remainder. People have bought hundreds of remainder books, and you'd be surprised when you go through those lists. You'd be surprised the great authors, you know, the famous authors, they have remainder books too. And you can get a $10, $20 book for $2. That's why I get my Christmas presents. The book presents, I usually go to the remainder catalogs and send. And oh, you get marvelous books.
What's the name of one of the companies that has a catalog like that?
Well, I forget. Publisher something. Does anyone else do that?
I never heard of it.
Publisher Central Bureau?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Sure. Publisher Central Bureau. And where it is. They're usually off in some remote place in the east.
We're on the mailing list. I don't know where it is, but you can
find it. But you can find out through libraries. Libraries are supposed to tell you anything, my daughter, who's a librarian, tells me. So just ask your librarian.